Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. The top story on the front page is You Can't Be a Firefighter Forever. Savoy hires Champaign Chief Kornstrom as next administrator. One municipality has concluded its search to fill a major position, and another is just getting started. The Savoy Village Board voted unanimously Wednesday night to appoint Champaign Fire Chief Andy Kornstrom as village administrator. He'll start on July 14th. You can't be a firefighter forever, said Kornstrom, who turned 50 in August, and I was fortunate enough to get hired young, and so I've started thinking about what my next career is and life after the fire service and public administration. Really seemed like something that I was experienced in but also passionate about. He is also intrigued by Savoy's growth and the various projects it has going on, including the future Curtis Road underpass and efforts to develop a downtown square. Kornstrom said he looks forward to carrying the torch that Christopher Walton lit and carried up to this point. Walton recently left the role of village administrator to join Champaign as deputy city manager. Monday was his first day on the job. Village President John Brown said that Savoy's top priorities during the candidate search included a strong leadership background and municipal experience. I really wanted to find somebody who would work well with the current staff, he added. Kornstrom's experience includes serving as the City of Champaign Township Supervisor for a little over 10 years, having been elected in 2013 and re-elected twice. He holds an associate degree in paramedicine, a bachelor's in business administration, and a master's in public administration. Kornstrom left the position of township supervisor in early 2024 to take on the role of fire chief. This year marks 28 since he joined the Champaign Fire Department. I've made so many friends and people that I consider family and so many memories, but 28 years in the fire service is a long time, he said, and being chief has been the greatest honor of my life, but it can also take a toll on you. And so it's bittersweet. I'm excited for the opportunities. I'm going to miss the memories, but I'm also 100% confident in our staff. Kornstrom noted that he has one of the first internally hired Champaign fire chiefs in nearly 50 years and added, I hope to not be the last. Lights, camera, and reaction. Monticello thrilled to host movie production before it moves on to Paxton. Hollywood has come to Monticello. Chili Fingers, starring Judy Greer, Sean Astin, Bryan Cranston, and John Goodman, is filming in the former Hardee's location on North Market Street. The film is based on a true story. Greer's character, an empty nester who finds a human finger in her bowl of fast food chili, decides to leverage the incident for a payout. The film crew is expected to be in Piatt County until Thursday before moving on to Paxton on Friday. Director of Community Development Callie Jo McFarland said the city was approached a few weeks ago about the former Hardee's location being used. The city is a regional partner of experienced Champaign-Urbana. With film production being a strong focus at the State Tourism Office, ECU often gets leads on filmmakers needing certain set and scene requirements. As a result, we often get requests for proposals from specific area for specific area requirements needed, McFarland said. This one just happened to work out perfectly with the property owner and timeline when approached a few weeks back. McFarland said the film crew has been phenomenal to work with. We were able to coordinate with adjacent properties and regular users of all the spaces to make sure that there weren't any conflicts for you, she said. Other than that, it's just been a lot of communication to make sure people are patient with the process and the experience is a good one overall. Shelley Crawford Stock, the executive director of the Monticello Chamber of Commerce, agreed the experience has been positive. For the community, I just think it is fun, she said. Something unique and exciting is happening, and the community has gotten behind it. Crawford Stock said seeing the final product will be exciting. I think for our own community, being able to go, oh, that shot was in Monticello, and we know it because we recognize something will be neat. Crawford Stock said that if the new owner of the Hardee's building had been a few more weeks into their remodel, the movie using the building may not have been possible. The new owner was not ready to move forward anyway, so it was really good timing, Crawford Stock said. Crawford Stock said having the production in the area has been beneficial for local businesses. It's nice to know we can help with it, Crawford Stock said, and it's fun. There's a little bit of economic boost for the area. McFarland said the city is thrilled with the exposure, and it is also hopeful it will help people realize the different ways economic development can happen in the area. It isn't just about a new business coming to town, but all the activity that spurs from opportunities like this, she said. The actors and crew have visited some of our local businesses, and the community has gotten extensive exposure overall from this experience. McFarland said the city is open to future productions. If the project is right for the community, of course, she said. Rural communities like Monticello can have potentially the same opportunities as our urban counterparts. We just have to fight twice as hard to be seen. Research takes aim at cancer in pets and people. VetMedWork focus of PBS documentary series episode. From emotional support pets to livestock, animals help humans in numerous ways, and some researchers at the University of Illinois hope to return the favor. One is Timothy Fan, whose numerous titles include director of the Veterinary Clinical Trials Center and program leader for the Cancer Center in Illinois. A lot of pets that develop cancer, they have some very interesting and memorable, what we call paraneoplastic syndromes. These are clinical manifestations that are very, very unique and usually caused by some underlying cancer, Fan said. You just don't forget those cases. Those are the cases that you just remember and you tell stories about. That's part of what drew him to focus his research on veterinary oncology, with a special focus on bone cancer called osteosarcoma, typically found in large dogs, and a mouth cancer called oral squamous cell carcinoma, typically found in cats. His work will be featured in an upcoming episode of PBS documentary series Shelter Me, which highlights the bond between humans and animals. The Cancer Pioneers, the episode including Fan, is available on the PBS website and will air locally on WILL at 9 p.m. Monday. While Fan loves helping animals and giving them more time with their owners, he says that isn't the whole story. Science drives these discoveries, and the discoveries can benefit pets with cancer as well as people with cancer, and there is a lot more commonality between those two health systems, veterinary and human, that we probably don't recognize, Fan said. Alongside the interesting related symptoms, Fan was drawn to veterinary oncology because, he jokes, it's really science-y. Cancers are notoriously difficult to treat, and Fan sees plenty of opportunity to advance the field and re-examine treatments to improve them. Also, he said, people who bring in their pets for cancer treatment have a unique perspective, understanding they are on the same team with veterinarians and celebrating any success. These are the pet owners that are just super appreciative. They're like, every moment that you give me longer with my loved pet is a treasure. Fan said, we're both here to try to provide better outcome, a longer and better quality of life for their loved pet. The difference between veterinary medicine and human medicine is that animals don't have the capacity to explain how they feel or track symptoms. As Fan points out, though, the same could be said of pediatric or neonatal medicine. Young children and infants similarly can't speak for themselves. That means that doctors need to be tuned in to their patients' nonverbal cues and behaviors, he said. Very importantly, just like with neonatal doctors relying very heavily upon parents' observations, they know their child the best. They know the mood, the behaviors, the nuances, Fan said. Similarly, on the veterinary side, we rely very heavily on pet owners. Some pet owners are very, very, very detail-oriented. They're very observant. They understand every subtle changes in behavior. He's especially interested in comparative oncology, understanding similarities and differences between cancer in animals and humans in order to advance treatment of both. But Fan says there are overlaps in other conditions shared by multiple species. Of his current research foci, osteosarcoma also typically develops in human teenagers, and oral squamous cell carcinoma falls under head and neck cancers in humans. The University of Illinois is an extremely deep university when it comes to research and science. The College of Veterinary Medicine leads that front with regards to cancer discovery, Fan said. Coupled with, now, the Cancer Center at Illinois, you have a whole host of very talented, intelligent scientists that are developing new technologies that can be translated through and inclusive of pets with cancer that ultimately will hopefully make impact and life-saving changes for people. Teacher of the Week, Mandy Crow, Library Media Specialist, Carrie Busey Elementary School, Savoy. As Library Media Specialist at Carrie Busey Elementary School in Savoy, Mandy Crow sees students evolve through the books they read. In her 3 years on the job, she has worked to curate those choices while teaching kids to ingest information in a variety of ways. The Bloomington native began her career teaching in Normal for 3 years, and she spent the last 10 at Carrie Busey, where she taught second grade for 3 years before moving on to her current role. I find my work important because being a teacher is the most important job there is. Educating the future generation is what keeps the world turning. I started teaching in the primary grades, where students make the most growth in reading. Watching a child go from only knowing the letter names and sounds to being a proficient reader was such a special experience every year. Now in the library, I get to take that a step further and focus most of my energy on igniting the love of reading in my students. Additionally, especially with 3rd through 5th grades, we work on being kind online, researching skills, evaluating sources for credibility and bias, and citing our sources. All of these skills are critical for students to have in order to thrive and positively contribute in the digital age. I became a teacher because all of my skills and experiences were pointing me in that direction. My first job was as a swim instructor to the sweetest group of 2-year-old girls. Then I worked at Barnes & Noble for a few years in college. My past in theater was a big part of it as well. The ability to get up in front of an audience and perform is an essential skill in teaching. Whether you are having the best day of your life or the worst, when you get in front of that classroom, you are on a stage, and to be captivating helps engage your learners. I knew I had the skills, but then actually having my first group of students and watching them grow and thrive solidified for me that this was a job I was not only capable of, but it was also quite fulfilling. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is one that I do with 5th graders about media bias using a book called Seen and Unseen by Elizabeth Partridge. The book highlights 3 different photographers who took pictures in Manzanar, a Japanese internment camp during World War II. Each photographer has a different reason for taking pictures, that is, paid by the government versus sneaking a camera in as a prisoner. An opinion of the internment camps. Not only do we learn about Japanese internment camps, but we also get to see that photographs have bias. One photographer who agreed the camps were necessary made sure to pose his subjects and turned in pictures of mostly smiling faces and cozy-looking bungalows. Alternatively, another photographer was taking illegal pictures and made sure to capture what was truly happening and what was not allowed to be captured by government-hired photographers. We have such rich discussions about the humanity of the camps as well as how biased the media can be, even for something as seemingly black and white as a photograph. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when, being a school librarian, I get to see the same kids for more than just a year. It is really fulfilling to see how diverse their book selections get from when they start at Carrie Busey to when they leave. It takes a village to unfold a reader, but I get to see the side of the student that chooses a book for enjoyment, and seeing kids excited about a new book or a book they have been wanting to read is the best part of my job. When kids tell me how much they have enjoyed a book I recommended, or when I see them flying through a series that I helped put in their hands, is amazing. It only takes one book to ignite the passion for reading, and I'm on a mission to help each kid find that book. I keep students engaged by changing it up every once in a while. I read a lot of books to each class, but I also throw in an author study or a unit on Google skills. We do digital citizenship lessons or create projects on Canva. The library is so much more than reading books. It is a hub for many essential lifelong skills like typing, being a good digital citizen, computer skills, coding, research, writing poetry, etc. It's hard to fit it all in. Something else I'm passionate about is, this may seem obvious and like a cop-out, but I am really passionate about reading. I read a lot, and I find so much joy in not only the stories, but also being able to recommend books to my friends. I suppose if I had any other career, it wouldn't seem like such an obvious answer. Actually, my middle name is Reed, which is so incredibly fitting. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, my favorite teacher was Mrs. Heisler in first grade. I vividly remember her dressing up like Pippi Longstocking after we finished reading the book together. She made school magical, and I try to live up to that standard every year. Excuse me. Oddly, my favorite subject wasn't usually reading until the last few years of high school, when I could pick the English language arts classes that interested me, and I felt more like reading for fun. I was always good at math, and I liked figuring things out. The first day of math class in freshman year of high school, my teacher did a cartwheel into the classroom. This goes back to what I said about teaching being a performance. My most memorable and favorite teachers were the ones that gave it their all. It's hard to sustain when you're in the daily grind of work, but it is what teachers at large strive for. If I weren't a teacher, I would be probably an instructional designer for teaching at the college level. I don't see myself in any career that doesn't have at least one foot in the classroom. I'm spending my summer usually reading, hanging out with my kids, and working at Indian Acres Swim Club. This summer I'm also on the planning committee for the Association of Illinois School Librarians Conference in October at the I Hotel, which is keeping me pretty busy. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. No better way to kick off REO Week than a milestone episode of Homegrown KIO. Sunday 7 p.m. show on WKIO 105.5 FM is the 200th since L.A. Frederickson and Dave Leak introduced the all-local music format on August 22, 2021. Excuse me. It's the perfect lead-up to the June 14th concert, saluting the legacy of CU's favorite band, REO Speedwagon, at State Farm Center. Sunday's playlist is stuffed with REO's best, some originating for their gigs at Red Lion Inn on campus. Not only has Homegrown spotlighted famous performers, but young guns like Lexi Tiefel, Gina Miles, and Logan Allen, too, in compiling more than 1,400 tracks. We're also preserving history, Leak said, by working with U of I's SUSE Archives and Center for American Music. All REO Week will play out in these pages, too, including a special concert section that publishes June 13th. It includes our conversation with several of REO's original members, as well as Peter Tamara's memories of those crazy days at the Red Lion. Meta Inc.'s 20-year deal with Clinton Nuke Plant. Electricity needed to power AI, other computing needs. Meta has cut a 20-year deal to secure nuclear power to help meet surging demand for artificial intelligence and other computing needs at Facebook's parent company. The investment with Meta will also expand the output of a Constellation Energy Illinois nuclear plant. The agreement announced Thursday is just the latest in a string of tech nuclear partnerships as the use of AI expands. Financial details of the agreement were not disclosed. Constellation's Clinton Clean Energy Center was actually slated to close in 2017 after years of financial losses, but was saved by legislation in Illinois establishing a zero-emission credit program to support the plant into 2027. The Meta agreement takes effect in June of 2027, when the state's taxpayer-funded zero-emission credit program expires. With the arrival of Meta, Clinton's new clean energy output will expand by 30 megawatts, preserve 1,100 local jobs, and bring in $13.5 million in annual tax revenue, according to the companies. The plant currently powers the equivalent of about 800,000 U.S. homes. George Gross, professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois, estimates that 30 additional megawatts will be enough to power a city with about 30,000 residents for 1 year. Securing clean, reliable energy is necessary to continue advancing our AI ambitions, said Irvi Parakh, Meta's head of global energy. Surging investments in small nuclear reactors comes at a time when large tech companies are facing two major demands: a need to increase their energy supply for AI and data centers, among others, while also trying to meet their long-term goals to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions. Constellation, the owner of the shuttered Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, said in September that it planned to restart the reactors so tech giant Microsoft could secure power to supply its data centers. Three Mile Island, located on the Susquehanna River just outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, was the site of the nation's worst commercial nuclear power accident in 1979. Also last fall, Amazon said it was investing in small nuclear reactors, 2 days after a similar announcement by Google. Additionally, Google announced last month that it was investing in three advanced nuclear energy projects with Elemental Power. U.S. states have been positioning themselves to meet the tech industry's power needs as policymakers consider expanding subsidies and gutting regulatory obstacles. Last year, 25 states passed legislation to support advanced nuclear energy, and lawmakers this year have introduced over 200 bills supportive of nuclear energy, according to the Trade Association Nuclear Energy Institute. Advanced nuclear reactors from competing firms are filling up the federal government's regulatory pipeline as industry touts them as a reliable, climate-friendly way to meet electricity demands from tech giants desperate to power their fast-growing artificial intelligence platforms. Still, it's unlikely the U.S. could quadruple its nuclear production within the next 25 years, like the White House wants. The United States lacks any next-generation reactors operating commercially, and only two new large reactors have been built from scratch in nearly 50 years. Those two reactors at a nuclear plant in Georgia were completed years late and at least a $17 billion over budget. Additionally, Gross recommended that the U.S. invest more in the transmission grid that moves that power around. "That's my biggest concern," Gross said, adding that spending on the grid has fallen off in recent years, despite the voracious demand for energy. Amazon, Google, and Microsoft also have been investing in solar and wind technologies, which make electricity without producing greenhouse gas emissions. Capital News, Illinois. Bills on baby food safety, press freedom, state public defender head to governor. Governor J.B. Pritzker will have hundreds of bills to review after lawmakers concluded their spring session, including measures protecting press freedoms and baby food, as well as creating a state public defender's office. Lawmakers voted along party lines to pass House Bill 3363, which would create the Office of State Public Defender that would primarily be responsible for providing more resources to similar offices around the state. It also requires a local nominating committee to appoint or remove public defenders, a move designed to give them more independence from the judiciary. "Every Illinoisan deserves a strong defense, no matter their income," said the bill's sponsor, State Senator Robert Peters, Democrat, Chicago. "Instating this new system would ensure real help reaches people who have been left behind in conversations about criminal justice reform for far too long. Public defender offices throughout the state have been starved for resources, with some attorneys handling hundreds of cases at a time. Supporters of the legislation say the main goal of the new state office, at least initially, will be to provide more resources to these offices, which now are typically subject to the limitations of county budgets. Limited data show all Illinois counties need more public defenders. An analysis of county public defender budgets compiled by Northwestern University found that no counties have sufficient staffing in their public defender offices. State lawmakers appropriated $10 million for county public defense services in the fiscal 2026 budget and have appropriated as much each year since 2023. If signed by the governor, Peter's legislation won't fully take effect until 2027. Safer baby food. Lawmakers in both chambers unanimously passed Senate Bill 73, which bans the sale and distribution in Illinois of baby food that contains levels of toxic elements, including arsenic, cadmium, lead, or mercury, that surpass the limits set by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The bill now only needs a signature from the governor to become law. Under the bill, any manufacturer selling baby food in Illinois would be required to test a sample of their product monthly to ensure levels of toxic elements are in line with those set by the FDA. It also gives the Illinois Department of Public Health the right to request and review manufacturers' testing results and requires manufacturers to publish the levels of each toxic element in each of their products on their website. Manufacturers would also have to print a QR code on the label of any baby food that contains toxic elements limited by the FDA. The code will be required to direct consumers to the product's testing information and FDA guidelines on the health effects of the toxic element on children. The bill comes after a study published in 2019 by Healthy Babies Bright Futures found that 95% of 168 baby foods tested for toxic elements contained one or more contaminants. One in four of the baby foods tested in the study contained all four elements, with arsenic being found in 73% of baby foods tested and lead in 94% of the products. The study gained public traction after its publication, resulting in the creation and implementation of Closer to Zero, an FDA initiative that aims to reduce the percentage of toxic elements found in baby food to zero. If signed by the governor, the bill would take effect on January 1st. Press protections. Pritzker will also consider a measure to bolster protections for news media against lawsuits. Senate Bill 1181 explicitly adds news media as an entity protected under the state Citizen Participation Act, which prohibits strategic lawsuits against public participation. It passed the House 75-38 and the Senate 47-10. Stark calculations, Trump tax bill will add $2.4 trillion to the deficit and leave 10.9 million more people uninsured, agency says. President Donald Trump's big bill in Congress would unleash trillions in tax cuts and slash spending, but also spike deficits by $2.4 trillion over the decade and leave some 10.9 million more people without health insurance, raising the political stakes for the GOP's signature domestic priority. Republican leaders in Congress, determined to muscle the sweeping package forward, had little to say after the analysis released Wednesday by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. GOP senators were heading for an afternoon meeting with Trump at the White House. The Democrats, laboring to halt the march of Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, piled on with a relentless opposition. In the words of Elon Musk, "This bill is a disgusting abomination," said Representative Brendan Boyle of Pennsylvania, the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee, reviving the billionaire former Trump's aide's criticism of the package. The analysis comes at a crucial moment as Trump is pushing Congress, where Republicans have majority control, to send the final product to his desk to become law by the 4th of July. The House passed the bill last month by a single vote, but it is now slogging through the Senate, where Republicans want a number of significant changes. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.